lodges. I ride in this wind on my good heart.
The man is clear in his mind, but his soul is mad. Oh, yeah. He's dying, I think. He hates all this. He hates it.
Gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding.
You're listening to episode 674 of Unwelcome Guests. Sane methods, but insane purposes. I'm Robin Upton. And we've just heard a quick snippet from Apocalypse Now. Recommended viewing in case you've missed it. It was based, of course, on Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, published over a century ago about the European influence on colonial Africa. And the title is not inspired by that, but another 19th century novel, Moby Dick, Herman Melville's now established, but at the time pretty ill-received work about the whaling trade and the monomaniacal Captain Ahab, whose self-analysis is that his methods are sane, his purposes and aims insane. And we're going to be hearing Chris Hedges using Melville's work allegorically to describe the corporatocracy later on in the show. Now, Hedges is fairly stark in his conclusions, so I'm going to be tempering that with slightly more optimistic material. We have an interview I did a couple of years ago with gift economy pioneers from the UK, and we're also going to be concluding Charles Eisenstein's Ascent of Humanity. Lynn Gary missed out one subsection, and I think it's an important one, Human Nature Restored. So we're going to be hearing that, but to get us started, let's hear Marxist professor of econometrics, David Harvey, deconvoluting the spin about the financial crisis. And this is the soundtrack of an animation from June 28th, 2010.
Okay, so we've been through this crisis, and there are all sorts of explanatory formats out there, and it's interesting to look at the different genres. One genre is that it's all about human frailty. I mean, Alan Greenspan took refuge in the fact it's human nature, he said, and you can't do anything about that. But there's a whole world of explanations that kind of say it's the predatory instincts, it's the instincts for mastery, it's the delusions of investors and the greed and all the rest of it. So there's a whole range of discussion of that. And, of course, the more we learn about the daily practices on Wall Street, we kind of figure there's a great deal of truth in all of that. The second genre is that there's institutional failures. Regulators were asleep at the switch. The shadow banking system innovated outside of their purview, etc., 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 and therefore institutions have to be reconfigured, and it has to be a global effort by the G20, something of that kind. So we look at the institutional level and say that has failed and that has to be reconfigured. The third genre is to say everybody was obsessed with a false theory. They read too much Hayek and believed in the efficiency of markets, and it's time we actually got back to something like Keynes, or we took seriously Hyman Minsky's theory about the inherent instability of financial activities. The next genre is that it has cultural origins. Now, we don't hear that much in the United States, but if you were in Germany and France, many people there would kind of say, this is an Anglo-Saxon disease, and it's nothing to do with us. I happened to be in Brazil when it was going on, and Lula was kind of saying, well, first off, he was saying, oh, thank God the United States is being disciplined by the equivalent of the IMF. We've been through it 8 times in the last 25 years, and now it's their turn. Fantastic, said Lula, and all the Latin Americans I knew, until it hit them, which it does, and then they kind of changed their tune a little bit. So there's a kind of a way of which it became cultural, and you can see that, by the way, in which this whole Greek thing is being handled, the way the German press is saying, well, it's the Greek character, it's defects in the Greek character, and there's a lot of rather nasty stuff going on around that, but actually there are some cultural features which have led into it. For instance, the U.S. fascination with home ownership. which is supposedly a deep cultural value. So 67, 68% of US households are homeowners. It's only 22% in Switzerland. Of course, it's a cultural value in the United States that's been supported by the mortgage interest tax deduction, which is a huge subsidy. It's been promoted since the 1930s, very explicitly in the 1930s, it was built up because the theory was that debt-encumbered homeowners don't go on strike. And then there's a kind of notion that there's a failure of policy and that policy has actually intervened. And there's a funny kind of alliance emerging between the Glenn Beck wing of Fox News and the World Bank, both of whom say the problem is too much regulation of the wrong sort. So there are all of these ways, and all of them have a certain truth. And skilled writers will take one or other of those perspectives and build a story and actually write a very plausible kind of story about this. And I thought to myself, well, what kind of plausible story can I write which is none of the above? Which is one of the things I always think to myself. And it's not hard to do, particularly if you're coming from a Marxist perspective, because, you know, there aren't many people who try to do this analysis from a Marxist perspective. And I was really, really clued into this by this thing that happened at the London School of Economics about a year and a half ago, when Her Majesty the Queen asked the economists, how come you guys didn't see this thing coming? I mean, she didn't say it exactly that way, but, you know, it's just the sentiment. And they got very upset, and then she actually called the governor of the Bank of England and said, how come you didn't see it coming? And then the British Academy put forward this, got all together, all of these economists, and they came up with this fabulous letter to Her Majesty. And it was it was absolutely astonishing. It said, well, you know, many dedicated people, intelligent, smart, spent their lives working on aspects of this thing very, very seriously, but the one thing we missed was systemic risk. And you say, what? And then it went on to talk about a politics of denial and all the rest of it. So I thought, well, you know, systemic risk, you know, I can translate it into the Marxian thing. You're talking about the internal contradictions of capital accumulation. And maybe I should write a thing about the internal contradictions of capital accumulation and try to figure out the role of crises in the whole history of capitalism and what's specific and special about the crisis this time around. And there were two ways in which I thought I would do that. One was to sort of look at what's happened since the 1970s to now. And the thesis there is that in many ways the form of this current crisis is dictated very much by the way we came out of the last one. That the problem back in the 1970s was excessive power of labor in relationship to capital. That therefore the way out of the crisis last time was to discipline labor. And we know how that was done. It was done by offshoring. It was done by, you know, Thatcher and Reagan. And it was done by neoliberal doctrine. It was done all kinds of different ways. But by 1985 or 86, the labor question had essentially been solved for capital. It had access to all of the world's labor supplies. Nobody in this particular instance has cited greedy unions as the root of the crisis. Nobody in this instance is saying it has anything to do with excessive power of labor. If anything, it's the excessive power of capital, and in particular the excessive power of finance capital, which is the root of the problem. Now, how did that happen? Well, we've been since the 1970s in a phase of what we call wage repression, that wages have remained stagnant. The share of wages in national income right throughout the OECD countries has steadily fallen. It's even steadily fallen in China, of all places. So that there are less and less being paid out in wages. Well, wages turn out to be also the money which buys goods. So if you diminish wages, then you've got a problem with where's your demand going to come from? And the answer was, well, get out your credit cards. We'll give everybody credit cards. So we'll overcome, if you like, the problem of effective demand by actually pumping up the credit economy. And American households, British households, have all roughly tripled their debt over the last 20, 30 years. And a vast amount of that debt, of course, has been within the housing market. And out of this comes a theory which is very, very important, that capitalism never solves its crisis problems. It moves them around geographically. And what we're seeing right now is a geographical movement of that. Everybody says, well, okay, everything's beginning to recover in the United States, and then Greece goes bang, and everybody says, what about the pigs, you know? And it's interesting. You had a finance crisis which in the financial system. You've sort of half solved that, but at the expense of a sovereign debt crisis. Actually, if you look at the accumulation process of capital, you see a number of limits and a number of barriers, and there's a wonderful language that Marx uses in the Grundrisse, where he talks about the way in which capital cannot abide a limit. It has to turn it into a barrier which it then circumvents or transcends. And then when you look at the accumulation process, you look at where the barriers and limits might lie. And the simple way to look at it is to say, look, a typical circulation process of accumulation goes like this. You start with some money, you go into the market and you buy labour power and means of production, and you put them to work with a given technology and organisational form. You create a commodity, which you then sell for the original money plus a profit. Now, you then take part of the profit and you recapitalise it into an expansion for very interesting reasons. Now, there are two things about this. One is there are a number of barrier points in here. How is the money got together in the right place at the right time in the right volume? And that takes financial ingenuity. So the whole history of capitalism has been about financial innovation. And financial innovation has the effect of also empowering the financiers. And the excessive power of the financiers can sometimes, they do get greedy, no question about it. And if you look at financial profits in the United States, they were soaring after 1990. They're going up like this. Profits in manufacturing were coming down like this. And you could see the imbalance in this country. I think the way in which this country has sided with the City of London against British manufacturing since the 1950s onwards has had very serious implications for the economy of this country. You've actually screwed industry in order to keep, you know, financiers happy. Any sensible person right now would join an anti-capitalist organisation. And you have to, because otherwise we're going to have the continuation. And notice it's a continuation of all sorts of negative aspects. For instance, the racking up of wealth. You would have thought the crisis would have stopped that. Actually, more billionaires emerged in India last year than ever. They doubled last year. The wealth of the rich, I mean, just read something this morning, in this country has accelerated. Just last year, what happened was the leading hedge fund owners got personal remunerations of $3 billion each in 1 year. Now, I thought it was obscene and insane a few years ago when they got $250 million. But they're now hauling in $3 billion. Now, that's not a world I want to live in, and if you want to live in it, be my guest. I don't see us debating and discussing this. I don't have the solutions. I think I know what the nature of the problem is. And unless we're prepared to have a very broad-based discussion that gets away from, you know, the normal kind of pablum you get in the political campaign and, you know, everything's going to be okay here next year if you vote for me, you know, it's crap. You should know it's crap and say it is. And we have a duty, it seems to me, those of us who are academics and seriously involved in the world, to actually change our mode of thinking.
And the soundtrack stops there. The images continue for a little bit. We see a picture of some hedge fund managers in jail. Now, even if Professor Harvey doesn't want to put that into words, it's quite a thought to play with. Imagine if people were judged by the consequences of their actions, not by their position in hierarchies of power. Things might look quite different, say, for former government leaders who started wars knowingly based on lies, or for people who were involved in fabricating evidence and broadcasting it as part of elaborate war propaganda campaigns. Just as they might look quite different for people who are sitting in jail for drug offences. But I'm not looking for small increments, not looking for minor changes to the status quo, as much as questioning the entire framework. So to help us do that, let's read now Charles Eisenstein's Ascent of Humanity. This is the first section of
the final chapter, Self and Cosmos.
Human Nature Restored. On a country hilltop, one fall day, a herbalist challenged me to recall where I'd gotten the belief that I'm bad. For in spite of the entire intellectual edifice I've presented in this book, on a deep, emotional level I had, like many of us, long been convinced of my inherent unworthiness. "Who first told you you were bad?" she asked. I couldn't answer her truthfully. If there was a time when I was first told, or when I first accepted that awful proposition, I can't remember it. I suppose I could try to pin the blame on Mum or Dad or teacher, but the fact is that their use of shame, conditional praise, guilt and so forth, was the near helpless channeling of ambient cultural forces. The message, "You are bad," saturates our entire civilization, relentlessly pounded into us from early childhood. It's bound to our most fundamental beliefs about self and world. In science, this belief manifests as the selfish gene, the biological discrete and separate self that succeeds by outcompeting the rest of nature. In religion, it is the total depravity of man, or any doctrine that originates in the separation of body and soul, spirit and matter. In economics, it's the economic man, the rational actor motivated to maximize his or her financial interest. The result is the world under control, seeking to rein in the behavior which we mistake for human nature that arises from these beliefs. And the apparatus of the world under control, the willpower and the coercion and the rules and the incentives, instills and reinforces the message, "You are bad." The message is everywhere. No littering, $300 fine. The assumption is that the threat to our self-interest best reins in our natural selfish carelessness. The teacher, "Without grades, how would we make the students learn?" Unless coerced, they're naturally lazy and content with ignorance. A parent, "I'm gonna make you stay here until you say you're sorry." People have to be made to feel sorry. A state law, parents must provide a written excuse signed by a doctor for absences due to illness exceeding 7 days. "Johnny, how could you?" "You have to. You cannot afford to. You must. You should. Nature and human nature is hostile, uncaring, neither sacred nor innately purposeful, and it is up to us to rise above it, to master it, to control it. Over nature, we exercise the physical control of technology to make it safer, more comfortable, more bounteous. Over human nature, we exercise a psychological technology of control to make it kinder, less selfish, less brutish and bestial. These are the two aspects of control on which our civilization is based." In this book, I've described the inevitable collapse of the program of control. Inevitable because it is founded ultimately on falsehoods. And in Chapter 7, I describe the world that might arise after the convergence of crises has ended it. In this, the final chapter, I'll describe an alternative to trying harder to be good, i.e. less selfish, more ethical, less greedy, etc., based on a faith in nature and human nature. To inspire and sustain such faith in the face of the immense suffering that separation has brought, I will also describe the dynamics of separation and reunion, so that we may see the cosmic necessity and purpose of our long journey of separation, both as individuals and collectively, and not resist the next stage of our development. If our ruinous civilization is built on a struggle of good versus evil, then its healing demands the opposite: self-acceptance, self-love, and self-trust. Contrary to our best intentions, we will never end the evil and violence of our civilization by trying harder to overcome, regulate, and control a human nature we deem evil. For the war on human nature, no less than the war on nature, generates only more separation, more violence, more hatred. "You can kill the haters," said Martin Luther King, "but you cannot kill the hate. The master's tools will never dismantle the master's house." The same applies internally. You can go to war against parts of yourself you think are bad, but even if you win, like the Bolsheviks and the Maoists, the victors become the new villains. The separation from self that the campaign of willpower entails cannot but be projected eventually, in some form, onto the outside world. Yeah, sure, self-acceptance. The concept is pretty much a cliché these days. In its full expression, though, the path to reunion of self-acceptance, self-love, and self-trust is utterly radical. challenging cherished doctrines of how to be a good person. Let me state it as purely as I can. The path to salvation for us as individuals and as a society lies in being more selfish, not less. How could this be? Isn't it precisely selfishness and greed that has gotten us into this mess? No. What we see as selfishness arises from a false view of the self. Our cultural assumptions about who we are have defrauded us of our birthright, yoking us to the aggrandizement of an illusion. As a new understanding of self arises, selfishness will come to mean something quite different. Already the illusion wears thin. Already we see the bankruptcy of the program of security and success that defines the winners in our society. Already we see, for example, how financial independence has cut us off from human community, how technological insulation from nature has isolated us from the community of life. Increasingly, the program of control fails even to benefit the limited, discrete and separate self of our illusions, as health, economy, polity and environment deteriorate. Ironic indeed, given the ostensible goals of selfishness, security, pleasure and wealth. That is why the road to the golden future that is possible for us, collectively and as individuals, is not a path of sacrifice and effort, but simply an awakening to what was true all along. In The Yoga of Eating, applying this idea to food, I wrote, quote, "When we deeply examine what we ordinarily think of as selfishness, we find a sad delusion. I imagine a vast orchard, the trees laden with ripe fruit, and myself sitting in the middle of it, warily guarding a small pile of gnarled apples. True selfishness would not be to guard an even bigger pile more carefully. It would be to stop worrying about the pile and open up to the abundance around me. Without such examination, you remain in hell forever, thinking that our 5,000-square-foot house didn't make us happy because what we really needed was 10,000 square feet. On the other hand, very often one must acquire a thing first in order to discover that it doesn't bring happiness after all. This is why even deluded selfishness is potentially a path to liberation, and why I urge you to be selfish as best you are able. Believe it or not, to be genuinely selfish requires courage. When the investment in something is large enough, we dare not ask ourselves if it has made us happy for fear of the answer. After staying in studying throughout high school and college, missing all those fun times, then all those years of med school, then all those sleepless nights as an intern, after all those sacrifices, dare you admit that you hate being a doctor? To be selfish is no easy thing. How many of us, in our heart of hearts, are really good to ourselves? The realm of food is a way to practice being good to yourself. Think of the greedy eater, eating more than his share, stuffing himself. That's an example of deluded self-interest, of not being good to oneself. The glutton really is getting more food, more, 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 but he is hurting himself. If he were more selfish, if he made being good to himself his number one priority, maybe he wouldn't eat so much. It's an irony and a miracle. When you really decide to be good to yourself with food, the end result is a healthier diet, not a less healthy diet. Even if the path to that diet might start out with an extra large helping of ice cream." Unquote. When I speak before audiences about radical self-trust, I observe a range of reactions, from grateful affirmation, "I've been waiting forever for this, I knew it all along, but I hardly dared believe it," to outraged protest, "This would wreck civilization as we know it." Both responses are correct. What would happen to civilization, for instance, if everyone trusted their innate repugnance for any job involving the degradation of themselves and others? I suspect that many people entertain both reactions, gratitude and protest, simultaneously. The conditioned self fears the very freedom it so desperately desires, as, on the collective level, to live in self-trust on the personal level is to accept the end of life as we know it. Anything can happen, and everything could change. Job, environment, relationships, and more. In exchange for freedom, we must give up predictability and control. The ideology of control imbues every segment of political and religious belief. Just as religious conservatives believe we must clamp down on our sinful nature, environmentalists tell us to rein in our greed and selfishness, to stop polluting the world and hogging more than our share of resources. And practically everybody believes in work before play, not permitting ourselves to do as we really want until we've finished what we must, the mentality of agriculture. Anger and blame infuse the writing of crusaders left and right. Ideologues as opposite as Derek Jensen and Ann Coulter, John Robbins and Michael Shermer. Variations on a theme, that is all. Both sides express the guiding ideology of our civilization, just in a slightly different way. That is why, when one side wins over the other, nothing much changes. Even communism didn't end the domination and exploitation of man by man, let alone woman by man, or nature by man. This book proclaims a revolution of a wholly different sort. It is a revolution in our very sense of self, and, as a consequence, in our relationship to the world and each other. It will not and cannot arrive through a violent overthrow of the present regime, but only through its obsolescence and transcendence. Anyone who tells us we must try harder to be good is operating from the same set of faulty assumptions about human nature. Self-trust only makes sense if we are fundamentally good. Looking at human violence and our own failings, we conclude we are not. It appears that the source of violence and evil is ungoverned human nature, but that is a delusion. The source is the opposite, human nature denied. The source is our separation from who we really are. Does self-trust actually lead to a downward spiral of indolence and greed? It sometimes appears that if we relaxed self-control, we would yell at our children, pig out on junk food, sleep in every day, blow off our schoolwork, have promiscuous sex, quit the bother of recycling, indulge the nearest whim and maximize the easiest pleasure without regard to the consequences for others. But in fact, all of these behaviors are symptoms of disconnection from our true selves, not our true selves unleashed. We lose patience with children because of our own slavery to measured time, deadlines and schedules that conflicts with the rhythms of childhood and with all human rhythms. We pig out on junk food as a substitute for genuine nourishment, so lacking in industrially processed foods and anonymous lives. We want to stay up late and sleep in because we don't want to face the day or live the life scheduled for us. Or maybe we're tired from the nervous stress of the constant barrage of a life based on anxiety. We identify with professional athletes whose victories substitute for our own unrealized greatness. We covet financial wealth to replace the lost affluence of connection to community and nature. Perhaps all of our violence and sin is merely a flailing attempt to return to who we are. In other words, the evils of human nature are actually products of the denial of human nature. We are the victims, as well as the perpetrators, of a diabolical fraud that says we must guard against nature and human nature and ascend beyond both. In fact, as the illusion wears thin, magnificent people appear who show us the results of accepting, loving, and trusting ourselves. Whenever I meet one, I am reminded of the intensity of my own limitations and insecurity. There are people who maintain a hunter-gatherer mentality of affluence in the midst of modern society, When meeting them, my own uptightness reminds me of the Jesuit explorer Lejeune. Quote, I told them that they didn't manage well, and it would be better to reserve these feasts for future days, and in doing this, they would not be so pressed with hunger. They laughed at me. Tomorrow, they said, we shall make another feast with what we capture. Unquote. People like this are never constrained by, can I afford to? They have an open hand and an open heart, and somehow, it seems, they are always provided for. Recently I met a man, a shaman and artist, who doesn't charge for his services. His whole house is furnished with gifts from students and friends. Even without waiting for a restorative economy to appear, we can implement it in our own lives, simply by opening up to the gift economy and the gift ecology that replaces the money economy. To do that, we need only, simply, to give and to receive. To freely give and receive requires faith that it will be okay. I will be okay. The world will provide. And that will happen when we stop seeing the world as a separate and hostile other. That is the now crumbling illusion that sets us in anxious opposition to the world. We also see the magnificent results of self-trust in the geniuses of our society, the people who believed in themselves enough to devote years to the folly of their passions. I imagine Albert Einstein getting lectured by his boss in the Swiss Patent Office.
Al, you're never going to get anywhere doodling at your desk. You need good work habits like Muller over there. Come on, focus.
And maybe Einstein thought, you know he's right. I won't play around with relativity tonight. I'll take home a copy of Patents Today magazine and study up. If I work hard, I might even get a promotion. But instead, he was drawn to his equations, and his magazine was left unopened. His creative genius didn't come from disciplining himself to do what was prudent, practical, and secure, but from fearless devotion to his passion. So it is with all of us. Earlier I discussed how it is irrational to do anything better than necessary. For the grade, for the boss, for the market, where rational means of economic benefit to the separate self. It's only freed of the compulsion of necessity that we can devote ourselves fully to creating beauty. No one will ever create anything magnificent if, compelled by anxiety-based limits on time and energy, we make it only good enough for an economic purpose or to please an authority figure with power over us. Good enough isn't good enough for our own happiness and fulfillment. To do something for someone else because that person or institution holds power over you, the power of threat to your survival, is a good definition of slavery. Self-trust does not admit to conditions. We are accustomed to channeling our self-determination into safe, inconsequential, or highly circumscribed areas of life. I will honor my integrity, unless to do so would get me fired. I will listen to my body, but only if it doesn't want sugar. I will follow my heart's true desire, but not if it's to get rich. I'm not advocating we do without the things we want. I'm asserting that the things we really want often aren't what we think they are. Unfortunately, sometimes, the only way to find that out is to acquire them. How many people, upon finally achieving fame or fortune, learn that that wasn't what they really wanted after all? But they would never have known any other way. Deluded self-interest can be a path toward authentic self-interest. Perhaps the same is true for our entire civilization. Perhaps nothing less than the collapse of our civilization will be sufficient to awaken us to the truth of who we really are. Perhaps we must fulfill its grand ambition in order to realize its emptiness. True, the technological program can never be fulfilled in its entirety, but specific problems indeed succumb to the methods of control, the technological fix. Looked at piecemeal, the technological program is a great success. we have attained to a realm of magic and miracles. Godlike powers are ours. Yet, somehow, the world around us has fallen apart. Our confidence in technology is slow to fade, however, because its successes are undeniable within their own limited realm. Perhaps the only experience that can reveal the fraudulence of the technological fix is its irrevocable, undeniable failure on the broadest systemic level. Recall the metaphor of drug addiction from Chapter 1. The drug fix is not important to solve the immediate problem. The fix works. I feel bored, I feel uncomfortable, I feel depressed, I feel lonely, and the drug indeed removes these feelings, for the time being, contributing to the lie that the pain is fundamentally avoidable, even when its source remains untouched. In the case of technology, the lie is that we can avoid the consequences of our disruption of nature, that instead of bringing it back into balance, we can move farther and farther out of balance while covering for the damage already done. It's the lie that our debts need not be paid. It's the lie that there is no inherent purpose to the world beyond that of our own making, and therefore no consequences for disrupting it. It's the delusion that nothing is sacred, so we may wreck with impunity. Whether drug or technology, it works for a while, and hence its allure, so powerful that we imagine that the complications it causes, the further pain it engenders, can likewise be avoided by the same fixes, indefinitely into the future, until the final solution. In the case of drugs, often the addiction does not end until the complications it causes overwhelm its power to mask the associated pain. As the pain from a drug-wrecked life mounts, the power of the drug to numb the pain diminishes. Every asset, every recourse, is exhausted to keep the gathering problems under control. Life becomes unmanageable, and all the postponed consequences emerge to be experienced as a convergence of crises. The addict hits bottom. Life falls apart. The technological program, culminating in the complete elimination of suffering that dreamers think might be possible with the power of nanotechnology, is tantamount to imagining that someday alcohol or cocaine will not only temporarily remove the pain caused in large part by its previous abuse, but will also solve all the problems causing that pain. An absurd delusion, indeed. At each stage of an addiction, there is a possibility of seeing through the lie, not just with reason, but with the heart, and abandoning the program of control. It is no solution, not a lasting one, to apply the program of control to the addiction itself, to approach it with the attitude of self-denial. Quitting only works with the heartfelt realization that the fix was a lie, that I am denying myself something I don't want, not something I want. Otherwise, eventual relapse is inevitable. One purpose of this book is to forestall such a relapse. When crises converge and things fall apart, a new sense of personal and collective self will open up. Let us recognize that and build upon it when the time comes. Another purpose of this book has been to encourage us not to resist the transition. That's why it's important to describe the dynamics of transformation. In Chapter 5, I wrote, "Even worse than the disintegration of the orderly, stable, permanent-seeming life under control is for it to smoothly proceed until time and youth are exhausted. The longer we hang on, the greater the accumulated consequences. Already, the accumulated damage we humans have wrought over the last few thousand years is enough to cause the sixth great extinction in geological history and the demise of billions of people in the next century due to war, famine, and epidemic. if we continue to deplete our social, spiritual, and natural capital in a desperate gambit to control the consequences of control with yet more control, the eventual payback will be even worse. That is why the message, "Be good to yourself as best you know how," must be accompanied by a new insight into what it is to be good to yourself. The formula for success in our society is a formula for disaster, not only on a collective level, but individually too. The mortgaging of our life purpose to the demands of security and comfort leads ultimately to bankruptcy, and we are left lonely and sick, looking back on years wasted in a pursuit of a mirage. Yet those years, and I have wasted many myself, need not be entirely fruitless, not if we learn from them what the surrogate objects of our pursuits were really replacing. All I really wanted was intimacy. All I really wanted was nourishment. All I really wanted was comfort. All I really wanted was to love. All I really wanted was to express my magnificence. The question, then, is what is the true object that mankind, the technological species, is striving toward? For it appears that the ascent of humanity is actually a descent, a reduction of the unmediated richness of reality, an abandonment of the original affluence of foraging. But perhaps there is more. Perhaps we are groping towards something, a collective purpose or destiny, and have wrought endless ruin instead in pursuit of a substitute, a sham, a delusion. Maybe it was necessary that our quest take us to the very extremes of separation. Perhaps the reunion that is to follow will be not a return to a pristine past, but a reunion on a higher level of consciousness, a spiraling and not a circling. What is this transformational process that it requires such an extreme of separation? Where might it take us? Could there, after all, be a purpose, a transformational significance to the crescendo of violence that engulfs the planet today?
And now again, here an interview I made about 3 years ago with two pioneers of the gift economy who had the courage to step out into the new world because they wanted to get away from money. As we shall hear, it was a group of them who came up with this. It's a very simple idea. If you're an American, you probably know it as the really, really free market. In Europe, it's a free shop or a giveaway shop, and they refer to it as a give and take.
We found it best if the give and take is advertised in a flyer well before the event, so that people, with an explanation on it, saying exactly what you're doing, and people can bring things that they no longer need to put on the stall so that other people who want them can take them off. What happens if enough people know about it, they'll bring stuff with them to put on the stall. But if it's just done on the moment and you don't do that, people, you know, they just don't know what's going on, basically.
That's really important.
And, you know, you do get some people who, if you're on all day, will go back home and they'll come back later with stuff. But I really think it's a matter of getting it over to, you know, to people exactly what you're trying to do, you know, what's happening.
How did you get the idea for this?
Well, quite a long time ago, thank
you. We had a series of meetings about, we had a group called Well Health. But basically, we have a group called Well Health. Basically, it's going towards total self-sufficiency and total non-use of money. Because there's two ways you can go in life. You can be competitive and earn lots, or you can be not competitive and reduce down. Mm-hmm. I can't figure out the ins and outs of it, man. I can't figure out my mind not last enough to.
Yeah, I think it's the Connors Key Market.
We wanted to try and fund what we were doing. We thought we'd have a market store. Let's try a free store for some reason. I don't know where the idea came from.
Jackie
gave us the name. I said take it or leave it.
Take the leave it.
She said give and take. Call it give and take. That's how it's right. But we wanted to get out of money, you see, so I don't know how the spark came. Can you remember?
I think it was Jackie said, if, why not just do what you're always talking about this? Why don't you actually, when you put the store, instead of selling things to make a profit for what you're doing,
yeah,
why don't you just give things away? Yeah. In that way, you're sort of promoting what you're doing anyway, you know.
Yeah.
And anyway, so what we did on the day is we went home and looked what we had in the wardrobes, in the house that we all have things like lying around, don't you? That you're just not going to use. You don't need. You just have them there plonked down. So I looked around, put some stuff.
Yeah, I got all loads of
got some stuff on the stall and
all my fishing tackle.
We took it to the market. Set up the stall and put signs up saying give and take, and with an explanation leaflets. Yeah. And loads of people came up to before we started, just before we started saying, what are you doing? That'll never work. The stall holders, mainly. That'll never work.
Yeah.
That'll never work. People take all the stuff off the stall and you'd have nothing to, you'd have no stuff left. So we just carried on, regardless, and lo and behold, at the end of the day, we actually had more stuff than we started.
Yes.
And we carried on the market for 7 years, and we never ever come across a time when we had too much on the store most times.
So that we used to use a bit of the market store some of the stuff, so we didn't have to keep casting it back and forth. And one time, everything built up so much that we actually found that a bungalow was going to be demolished, and we filled up the bottom floor of the bungalow with the excess stuff that we had.
And what we used to do, another thing that was quite unusual for the store, is we'd set it up, then we'd go, we'd just leave
we'd
it.
Yeah, we'd go, we were looking for land.
We'd just leave the store, and then come back.
We'd go away about 9, 10 o'clock in the morning, and about 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
And people, you know, and there's a few times people actually started, they just jumped in and started helping and
it. Yeah. And there was one chap who used to run a hamburger van just opposite from us, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And Vic often talks about this, that he'd come up to Vicky and say, there was people there taking stuff.
Taking stuff, and they didn't pay. They definitely didn't give me any money. I just say, that's the idea. And he just could not get it. For the years, all the years we did it, he just did not get it.
Yeah.
He'd say, at the end of me explaining what he was doing, he'd say, yes, but they didn't give any money. That happens on the store when you explain to somebody that you don't want any money because they're fiddling for money. You say, no, all right. And you talk to them and say, well, it's all about, we don't want any money, just take it off, and other people put things on the store. And as they're going, they throw a pound on the store and say, well, there's a pound anyway, donation.
Did you have a donations box?
We tried to separate it off from the store donation box.
We had that because people couldn't afford sort of wanting to give you money, so we had this donation box, and in order to create an equality in that the people running the store were the same as the people who were putting things on the store, so we were all in equality, and there wasn't really an owner-customer relationship. We decided that any money that we did get, that people were going to give us, would be used to put into an account. Nobody could get paid any expenses or anything from it, and that money could only be used to buy land, to increase the size of the store, to buy land eventually, to give and take on that land, and then that would bring in more donations, and then that would increase and increase and increase, and so eventually we'd buy the earth up, and we'd have a sharing. So it was like it would be illegal to sort of trade on that land. On our land, would be shared on it. So
Going back to stallers, Michael Bandick, he used to organise the stall. He used to come in and he used to explain what it's for, but I don't think he really knew what he was doing. Understood the really deep ins and outs of it. And he used to organise everything on the rails, neat. He put all the size coats, all the trousers, all the things, and put everything separate.
Yeah.
And spent, and then of course I used to not do much in France.
Well,
You're not helping to sort the stall out.
No, it wasn't like that. I'd be sitting down reading something while he was doing all this work. Little knowing that I'd been up till 3 o'clock in the night before doing stuff. You get these vibes coming over,
But the point about it was It works better when you don't touch the stuff, and people bring
like
it in boxes, and people love to rummage in it.
Yeah.
And I think that's when it works. It's an important point to make, and everybody doing the stall, is if it, somebody brings a box of stuff there, you don't sort it out.
Yeah.
You leave the box so other people can look into it and take what they want.
Yeah.
Another thing, if you have all coats the same size, or it, people tend to grab a handful of those, you know, and take them.
Mm.
I mean, all right, probably bring them back, something what they don't want. But it does work better in random chaos. Works better in chaos.
Mm.
The other little point I always can come up with is one day I had these. Some chap brought these rusty box, biscuit box of old bolts and bent nails and things, and we were sorting out what was real rubbish. We were trying to sort out what was real rubbish. You know, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Separate it from them. I said, I've got some real rubbish here somewhere. I've got a box of old rusty nails and things. No, if you want them. And I turned around to get it, and somebody walked off with it.
That was the same with plastic.
So you just don't know. That person didn't mind knocking them nails straight to use. You know, simple as that. You know, to him, there were nails, whether they're bent or whatever, you know.
It was the same, but it was the same with it. We had all sorts of bits and pieces.
Yeah, loads of odds and sods, and you know, you just don't know.
Yeah.
And some of the other stuff, which you think would go, didn't go like that. We had some suits. Some chap gave us some suits that had all these named brands on from top London tailors. You know, worth about £200 a suit. Perfect condition. And they were coming on and looking at them, trying them, and they'd take it off the rail. You're talking about now £500 suits, right? And they put the coat on, and they'd look at the side and say, no, I don't like it. They'd put it back, you know what I mean?
This is like when I was on the Orange, when you had coffee machines, ice cream, you name it, everything you could want in the canteen. And people would just take what they wanted. That's how I saw it. That's the way I saw it working, I suppose.
Yeah.
People would just come, you know, they wouldn't be filling their pockets up with yogurts and this, that, and the other, you know, they just knew it was there all the time, so they just just took what they wanted.
Many thanks to Vic Button and Frank Bowman for that interview and for their warm hospitality when I went to visit them. And Frank Bowman, by the way, is living on the land they bought with years of donations from people and give and take stalls, and he is creating a permaculture food forest in the mountains in Snowdonia. With that positive example of what we can achieve by having the courage to overcome negative views of how people will behave and from stepping into the gift, I think we're ready for Chris Hedges' rather bleak take on life in corporate-controlled America. This is a recording from October the 22nd, 2013. Hedges is speaking at Moravian College on the myth of human progress and the collapse of complex societies.
Perhaps the most prescient portrait of the American character and our ultimate fate as a species is found in Herman Melville's Moby Dick. Melville, in his novel, makes our murderous obsessions, blinding hubris, violent impulses, moral cowardice, and lust for self-destruction visible in his chronicle of a doomed whaling voyage. He is our foremost oracle, what William Shakespeare was to Elizabethan England, or Fyodor Dostoevsky was to Tsarist Russia. In Moby Dick, our country is given shape in the form of the ship, the Pequod, named after the Pequot Indian tribe exterminated in 1638 by the Puritans and their Native American allies. The ship's 30-man crew, there were 30 states in the Union when Melville wrote the novel, is a mixture of races and creeds. The object of the hunt is a massive white whale, Moby Dick, which in a previous encounter maimed the ship's captain, Ahab, by dismembering one of his legs. The maniacal quest, much like that of a civilization, dependent on fossil fuel, and the profits of global speculators assures the Pequod's destruction. And those on the ship, on some level, know they are doomed. Just as many of us know that our civilization and our ecosystem cannot stand the continued assault by corporate capitalism. But when a man suspects any wrong, it sometimes happens that if he be already involved in the matter, he insensibly strives to cover up his suspicions from himself, Ishmael says in Moby Dick. And much this way it was with me. I said nothing and tried to think nothing. How much longer can a financial system that depends on the Federal Reserve to purchase $85 billion in U.S. Treasury bonds, much of it worthless subprime mortgages, each month survive? How much more money, we are now at $15 to $20 trillion, can be looted from the U.S. Treasury by big banks and Wall Street firms before the financial system again implodes? How much longer can wages be driven down and suppressed while interest rates, which can soar to 30%, cripple us with debt peonage? The ecosystem is at the same time swiftly disintegrating. Scientists from the International Program on the State of the Ocean a few days ago issued a new report that warned that the oceans are changing faster than anticipated and increasingly becoming inhospitable to life. The excess CO2 and heat from the atmosphere is rapidly warming and acidifying ocean seas. This is compounded, the report noted, by increased levels of deoxygenation from nutrient runoffs from farming and climate change. The scientists call these effects a deadly trio that, when combined, are creating changes in the seas that, in their words, are unprecedented in the planet's history. The scientists wrote that each of the Earth's five known mass extinctions was preceded by at least one of these deadly trios: acidification, warming, and deoxygenation. They warned that, quote, the next mass extinction of sea life is already underway, the first such mass extinction in 55 million years. The University of Hawaii also released a new report saying that the effects of climate change are now inevitable. They cannot be stopped. At best, the rate of devastation can be slowed. The report predicted that over the next 50 years, temperature levels will rise to such a degree that human life in many parts of the planet will become unsustainable. Millions upon millions of people will flee as refugees. Millions of species will face extinction. Coastal cities such as New York and even inland cities such as London will become unlivable. Microbes seem set to inherit the earth. Yet we, like Ahab and his crew, do not change course. We do not trust our eyes or our brains. We trust in the myth of human progress, the absurd belief that human technology and ingenuity will save us, that somehow, although no one spells out how, we will all be able to adapt. This myth is abetted by the corporate assault on culture, journalism, education, the arts, and critical thinking. Those who speak the truth are marginalized and ignored, dismissed as pessimists in a culture that prides itself on a childlike optimism at the expense of reality. We have a mania for hope, which our corporate masters lavishly provide across the political and cultural spectrum to keep us passive. Friedrich Nietzsche in Beyond Good and Evil wrote that only a few people have the fortitude to look into what he calls the molten pit of human reality. A handful of artists and philosophers, for Nietzsche, are consumed by an insatiable curiosity, a quest for truth, a desire for meaning, and this sends them down into the bowels of the pit. They get as close as they can before the flames and heat drive them back. This understanding, Nietzsche wrote, comes at a high cost.